You're listening to the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse at bellydancegeek.com.
Hi, everybody. I'm Nadira Jamal, and welcome to episode 31 of the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse. The Clubhouse is looking for sponsors, so if you have a product, an event, or some kind of service that you'd like to promote to over 800 geeky belly dancers, drop me an email at nadira@nadirajamal.com. The Clubhouse is a place where dancers can get together and get information that's hard to get in classes and on DVDs. If you want to get help with the what, so things like moves or combinations or choreographies, it's really easy to find resources. But if you want some help with the why and the how, so things like musicality, culture, history, business, professionalism, that can be a little bit trickier to find. So every month I interview a different guest expert on a nice geeky topic. And we always have time for questions so you can geek out too. So if you think knowledge and creativity go together like chocolate and peanut butter, you are in the right place. Mm-hmm. My guest today is Roxanne Shelaby, who performs throughout Southern California, bringing her unique dance style, combining her Lebanese heritage and Egyptian soul. Roxanne is fortunate to have grown up surrounded by Middle Eastern arts. Her love of Middle Eastern music and dance first as a child, growing up at the family-owned The Fez and Cascades nightclubs. She began performing at the age of 16 at the request of Farida Fahmy, who is the lead dancer of the National Dance Troupe of Egypt, to represent the Rada Troupe. And she studied extensively with master teacher and choreographer Sahra, as well as with Farida Fahmy, Zahra Zuhair, Viviane, and Feiruz Aram. You can check out her upcoming documentary on The Fez at thefezdoc.com, spelled thefezdoc.com. Thanks so much for joining me, Roxanne.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be a part of this really wonderful forum for discussion about our dance form.
Yay! Now, can you tell us the story of how you got started in Middle Eastern dance?
Okay, sure. My father is a Syrian Lebanese, and Lou Shelaby, he was a musician and an owner of several nightclubs, as you mentioned in my bio. And so I was kind of born into this dance form. I started, my first performance was at the age of 5 at the Arabic church. We had a little dance class for little girls. So I got a taste very early of performing, which I love. And then growing up at my dad's second nightclub, the Cascades, watching belly dancers every night of the week, which was wonderful. Dancers such as Sahra C. Kent and Angelica and many other wonderful dancers from Southern California. And then when I was about 16, Sahra, who was like a big sister to me and is one of my dearest friends, was going to UCLA at the time working on her master's in dance ethnology and had become friends with Farida Fahmy. And there was going to be a show here in Los Angeles at an Arabic festival. So, you know, I was in high school, and it was my summer vacation, and Sahra said, hey, we're working on this show. Do you want to come with me to the rehearsal and meet Farida? And I said, sure. So I followed her along and hung out with them. And at the time, they needed a fifth dancer, and they didn't know who that fifth dancer was going to be. So as they were running choreographies, Sahra asked me to just mark the place of that fifth person so that they could, you know, choreograph. And I found Farida's style to be so comfortable and natural to me that I picked it up really quickly and ended up in the show. So I'm sorry, that was a very long answer to that question, but
wonderful. And how did you end up going from, you know, one little summer project in high school to a performing career?
Well, it was sort of a roundabout way. I mean, I had done that show with Sahra and Kamala Almansar, who's another wonderful dancer, and several other dancers that were in that group. And we had performed occasionally those choreographies that we learned from Farida. And then two things happened. Sahra went to Egypt and ended up staying there, and she was my link to the dance world. And at the same time, I went to college. And, you know, going to college and working two jobs to get through school didn't leave me a whole lot of time for dancing. So I didn't perform very much when I was in college and those years that Sahra was in Egypt. But I still, you know, had such a passion for it and watched videos all the time. And I always was dancing around the house. And once Sahra returned, and she started a dance company called Ya Amar. And at the time, I was also finishing college and having more time to, you know, have a life of my own. And I went back to dancing, and I was working with Sahra with the dance company. And that's how I really went back into performing and becoming a professional dancer.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, one thing that, you know, we often hear as dancers is that, you know, often Arab families discourage their daughters from becoming performers. But it sounds like you didn't have as much of an issue with that as a lot of people. Do you think that either that's overblown or did you have a special situation?
Actually, no. I did have quite a difficult time as well. And it's ironic, although my dad was a great lover and promoter of belly dancing, it's different when it's your own daughter. And he was very nervous about me becoming a professional dancer. You know, it's okay when you're the little girl at the club and everybody puts you on top of the table and, you know, claps and cheers for you and they think that dancing is wonderful. But then all of a sudden when you go to cross that line of becoming a professional dancer, that's something very different. And my dad used to say, you know, I understand why you love to dance. I understand the appeal of dancing and performing and the artistic side of it. But, you know, a good Arabic man is not going to marry you if you're a dancer. So I had to fight that for a long time. And unfortunately, I think it was such a difficult thing for my father that that show that I danced for Farida Fahmy and represented the Rida troupe, at the age of 16, he just couldn't handle it and didn't attend the show.
Oh, I'm so sorry. That must have hurt.
Well, it did at the time, but I understand it now. You know, it's a cultural thing, and it is very difficult for a lot of people. And, you know, you can't change a culture overnight, so...
Well, it sounds like you have a good loving attitude towards that.
You have to. You have to. Otherwise, you know.
Exactly. Now, you've done quite a lot of research into the history of belly dance in the Los Angeles area. Can you tell us how you got started in that process?
Sure. Well, it's, again, everything has been a roundabout process for me. So I grew up in this belly dance community because my dad was a part of it, and then, you know, at the age of 9 when I met Sahra, and like I said, she became like a big sister to me, and then we've grown to become like sisters. So I was always going to festivals and dance events and nightclubs and participating in the belly dance community here in the Southern California area. And I always, you know, listen to stories. I like to be around adults even as a child and listen to them talk. And especially about the Fez and the reason the whole Fez project came about was, you know, I would run into people, and I still today in 2015 run into people around Los Angeles that were around during the Fez days, which was started in 1959. And when they find out that I have a connection to the Fez, they all get this very dreamy, far-off look in their eyes, and they all start talking about the Fez and how wonderful the Fez was, and there's no place like it, and, you know, things like that. And I started to think to myself as I got older, you know, I don't think that this is a normal thing. Like when you grow up in the belly dance community, you just assume everybody else in the world understands the belly dance community. And then when you start to realize, hey, this kind of seems special. And then even though my dad owned the Cascades after it, which was also a great place in its own right, no one talked about it the way they talked about the Fez. And when I would go and I would be around dancers like Aisha Ali, like Feruz Aram, Jamila Salimpour, Antoinette Owyshek, and these dancers who are like the founding dancers in the Los Angeles area, and they all trace their roots back to starting at the Fez. I started to kind of put the points together and say, wait a minute, okay, this went back to the Fez, this person went back to the Fez, this musician started at the Fez, and all of it just kind of came together. And that's when I said, this, you know, this is a story that needs to be told.
So let's start talking about those early days. Mm-hmm. Now, you said that the Fez opened up in 1959. That's pretty good.
Yes.
So when we're talking about these early days, you know, one thing that I like to think about is not just when, but also who, you know, who was involved in this. So
definitely.
Can you tell us about some of the Middle Eastern ethnic communities who were living in Southern California at the time?
Sure. From what I understand, there was a large Armenian community, and I don't think necessarily right here in Los Angeles at the time. I know in Fresno there was a huge Armenian community, but there was, you know, a smaller community here in Los Angeles, and now Glendale, which is right outside of Hollywood, has become one of the largest Armenian communities. There's also a very large Syrian-Lebanese community, which is, you know, what my family kind of came out of. And a lot of people don't know what that means, just to clarify. So, for example, my family immigrated to the United States in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And at the time, they left a country called Syria. And they left to escape the persecution of the Turks during the Ottoman Empire. They were Christian Arabs, and so they left Syria. They came to the United States. My family specifically settled in the Lawrence, Massachusetts area, and then moved on to Boston. And so later on, I believe after World War II, when they carved up a lot of the Middle East and created Lebanon as a country, the area that my family came from then was a part of Lebanon. So if you ask my grandparents where they were from, they would say they were Syrian. If you ask my dad where he's from, he would say Lebanese because it was then Lebanon. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
And so later on, that was the early days, Syrian, Lebanese, and Armenians, and I believe some Turks as well, and some Greeks also. So then as time progressed into like the 70s, then you started to have large groups of Persians, Egyptians, and later on, you know, Lebanese from during the Lebanese Syrian, I can't even talk, I'm sorry, the Lebanese Civil War. And now there's pretty much everybody here.
Mm-hmm. I always think it's really interesting to find out who's been in a given area, because I think that's one of the biggest drivers of regional differences in our dances.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I know for a fact in Boston that we primarily have the same Syrian-Lebanese groups.
Yes.
As well as the later folks who came over during the Civil War, a whole lot of Armenians,
mm-hmm.
and also a lot of Greeks, and a lot of the Armenians and Greeks were actually coming from Turkey. So,
right.
You know, I find it really interesting that, you know, we have had very few Egyptians in Boston. And so for us, this whole Egyptian connection came much later than a lot of other people. So, you know, so much of this dance is making the audience happy. And so it's really interesting to find out who's vetting the dancers.
Absolutely. And it's interesting in the case of Los Angeles, and this was something that I didn't discover until I was researching for the Fez documentary, in that, you know, we have this idea that during those days, the 50s and 60s, everything was sort of a mixture of Greek, Armenian, Turkish, Arabic, and what became AMCAB. But I've come to find that in Los Angeles, although there were those kinds of places that had a mixture of different things, when my dad opened the Fez, he wanted to have a place that was specifically Arabic. And so it was strictly Arabic food, Arabic music, and Arabic-style belly dancing. As a matter of fact, the dancers who performed on the opening night in 1959 were Egyptian.
Mm.
And he tried in the beginning to bring people from the Middle East, specifically from Egypt, to perform at the Fez, and then it got a little more difficult with getting visas and so forth, and then he started cultivating dancers here. But it was always with a more specifically Arabic style, and even leaning more towards Egyptian, even though my dad's background was Syrian-Lebanese.
Do you think that that's because of the, you know, entertainment dominance of Cairo, or do you think there was another reason for that?
I definitely think it was due to that. And his, you know, he had a great love for Kulthum and a lot of the Egyptian great musicians, and he did spend some time in Cairo when he was in college and really loved it. So I think that had a lot to do with it.
So it sounds like, you know, the Fez had a very clearly Arabic standard for everything,
yes,
that it was doing. Do you have a sense of whether the other clubs were more mixed in the Los Angeles area?
To my understanding, yes, in the very beginning. And then later, other Arabic, you know, strictly Arabic places started opening up. I know there was a place called the Egyptian Gardens that was also in Hollywood, Shaker's Oasis, which I think is a hilarious name, but was also a very prominent club, you know, later in the 60s in Hollywood. You had the Seventh Veil, and those places, I think the difference was that it really then it geared its entertainment and its livelihood towards the Arab community only, whereas at the Fez you had a mixture of the Arabic community and the Americans who were trying to learn about this culture. And, you know, it was the 1960s, so everyone was looking to the East, and, you know, the Beatles were going to India, and, you know, all this kind of stuff was happening. People were becoming very excited about the Middle East, and then, you know, they had an opportunity to experience it for themselves. Can you hear me?
The last thing I heard was experience it for yourself.
Oh, no. Sorry. I'm trying to retrace my thoughts. So I was saying that the Fez was unique in that it did cater to the Arab community, but it also was a welcoming environment to Americans who were looking to experience this new culture.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad was very much like an ambassador to them. So he would explain the kind of food that you were eating. He would talk about the music. He would explain the dancing. So it became sort of like a cultural lesson for people.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that some people, even some Syrian Lebanese people who were mostly English speakers, and some of them only spoke a little bit of Arabic here and there, were unhappy when they would go to other Arabic places and they only spoke Arabic. And they didn't feel, you know, people didn't feel as welcome because it was so foreign. But, you know, they were also really great places to see amazing dancers. And from what I understand from the dancers of that time, they were all working six nights a week doing full shows. And the dancers were like, it was like a sisterhood, and they would kind of trade off and say, hey, I'm leaving the Fez, I'm going to go dance at Shakers, why don't you take my gig over here, and, you know, I'm going here, why don't you come over there? So there was a lot of, I guess, exchange among the dancers, and the dancers also spent a lot of time after their show going to see other dancers, which I think was really important in the formation of the dancers that they became.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, when we're talking about the club scene, I think especially for younger listeners, and when I say younger, I actually mean quite a lot of people, because I was born in 1980, and for me, growing up A nightclub was a place where people went out to like dance and drink and maybe go home with somebody, right?
Right. Yeah.
Same thing that we mean, especially in this era. So can you tell us a little bit more like what a night at the nightclub meant for the guests?
Sure. That is a really great question, and I'm glad that you asked that. As a matter of fact, my dad never called the Fez a nightclub. He called it a supper club. And, you know, if you can imagine maybe from watching old movies or something, Hollywood in its heyday, places like the Copacabana and the Brown Derby and those kind of, you know, iconic Hollywood supper clubs where you would go to a restaurant and it was black tie and people wore their, you know, in their nice gowns and their tuxedos or their nice suits. From what I understand at the Fez, there was even a... They had a red carpet in the front and one of those long awnings that went out to the street. So when you got out of your car, you were protected as you went into the building. Mm-hmm. And the Fez itself had two environments. So there was the downstairs, which was a more formal dining area. It was, you know, regular tables and chairs and a slightly raised stage. So if you were sitting downstairs in the dining area, you could really relate it to somewhere like the Copacabana. So for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, think of I Love Lucy and maybe those shows that Ricky Ricardo put on at the, I don't know what it was called. Was it the Copacabana? So very fancy, full shows put on for the public and several shows a night. Then, again, going back to the Fez, there was an upstairs, which was called the Sinbad's Cave. And that was a more Arabic-style room. It was smaller. There were, you know, low cushions and pillows on the floor. And the dancers would dance, and the musicians, everyone was much closer to the audience. So it was a more intimate experience.
Have trouble imagining wearing one of those, you know, big poofy evening dresses and sitting on pillows on the floor.
Well, I think probably, and from what I understand too, then we hit the 60s and then it became a lot of hippies that would come and there was a lot of celebrities because it's Hollywood and you're right down the street from Paramount Studios and a lot of the celebrities would come after they were finished filming and they would hang out at the nightclub. So I have a feeling there were two different kind of crowds. The evening gown crowd was downstairs, and the the crowd that was interested in it really experiencing the culture were upstairs.
Gotcha. Now, you know, we've talked a little bit about the audience and the clubs, but I'd like to talk about the musicians as well. Mm. Can you tell us about the folks who were playing at the time?
Yes. Now, that's where, you know, it becomes interesting because I think at the very beginning, like I mentioned, there were mostly musicians who had come from the Middle East. And then as that changed, then my dad started using more local musicians. So there was one really amazing musician. His name was Tufik Barham. He also was from the Syrian-Lebanese community, an Oudist, and really a legend in the community. So he was one of the staples of working at the Fez. My uncle was a drummer for a while when he wasn't doing other things, you know, helping to run the nightclub. And you had a lot of the Syrian-Lebanese, the Hanna brothers, who also come from the East Coast. And prior to coming out to California, when most of them came out here in 1949, and living in Boston, they would play at lots of events, maharajans and festivals on the eastern seaboard, and they would travel up and down playing parties there, and then they all came here to California, and they sort of all met up with each other and started playing at things here. But then you had, you know, a Greek musician. There was Lemmy Pasha, who was a Persian canoonist, and several musicians of different ethnicities, and they all came together. But when they were at the Fez, they would play only Arabic music, Maybe once in a while a Greek song, maybe once in a while have a nagila, but for the most part it was Arabic music. Did I answer your question?
You did. And,
Okay.
you know, was the music that was being played then similar to what we hear in clubs and restaurant gigs today, or are there major differences?
Well, it depends on which clubs and restaurant gigs you're talking. I mean, today it's all, CDs and it's electronics kind of music, but then it was a lot of Umm Kulthum. It was, Inta Omri. It was those types of songs, Michelle and Aziza. Those classic, what we consider classic belly dance songs, and some others that were more. What is the word in English? It's more like, I don't want to say folk songs, but I guess folk songs would be the best way to describe them. Some more Lebanese, Syrian Lebanese style folk songs.
That I think is interesting that we tend to forget is that a lot of these things that we think of as like big classics, if we're talking, 1959 through the late 60s, a lot of these are actually really recent hits at this point.
Yes.
This is what's hot in Cairo right now for these dancers.
Exactly. And you would be lucky if someone came from back home, from the old country. And it's funny because when I was little, I never knew what the old, all I ever heard was the old country and back east. And I never knew where these two places were, but I knew they were far away. So if you were lucky, someone came from the old country and they brought a record. And they would listen to the record and learn those songs. Or if you would have a musician that would, immigrate here and stay here, they would teach the other musicians those songs. But yeah, those were all very new and interesting, exciting songs for musicians and especially for dancers, because as a dancer in those days, you're improvising. You didn't know what you were going to get. You were lucky if, the band wouldn't debut a new song you had never heard on a Saturday night,
Moving
Excuse
on
me.
to the dancers. So who are some
Okay.
of the iconic dancers of that era?
Well, definitely Aisha Ali, who I'm sure everyone knows from, the dances of North Africa and so forth. A dancer that you should know if you don't, her name is Antoinette Owyesek. If you've looked at any of my Fez promotional materials and you see this amazingly gorgeous hourglass figure dancer, that's Antoinette. And my dad used to call her the casting director's dream. Because, if it's 1959, well, I guess this was maybe 60 or 61, and you have an Arabic nightclub in Los Angeles, and there are no belly dancers around, and all of a sudden, this little voluptuous, gorgeous Syrian girl walks in the door. You grab her and throw her on the stage, and that's pretty much what happened. So, she was one of the standard dancers at the Fez. Feyruz Aram, who is another dancer that if you don't know, you should know. She is an incredible dancer. And a lot of these dancers went on to teach dancers that we consider our dance mothers. So, for example, Feyruz learned from Aisha and from Antoinette. Feyruz went on to teach people like Angelika Nemeth and Sahra Kent. So, there's like a whole lineage that happens that started with dancers from the Fez. Another amazing dancer named Zanuba. Zanuba was is, excuse me, Armenian Egyptian. She was one of the dancers on the opening night at the Fez. And she had danced in Cairo as well as in Lebanon and Iraq before coming here and influenced many, many dancers. Marta Shill is another dancer that started at the Fez who Mardashil of Mekda and the Cairo Caravan and many amazing festivals here on the West Coast. Tonya Chianas, who, you know, Belly Dancer of the Universe competition, also a standard dancer at the Fez. So these are the, you know, these are the people that, you know, I just know them because I grew up around them, and they're just like average people to me as a child. That all of a sudden I go, wow, Tonya Chianas, who runs the Belly Dancer of the Universe Festival competition, you know, was one of the dancers at the Fez, along with all these other ladies that I mentioned. Jamila Salimpour, who was also a regular at the Fez, a very good friend of my father's. They had a little mutual admiration society going on. And although she was there at the first night of the opening of the Fez, she sold an oud to my father because there were no instruments around that you could buy. And she happened to have an oud in her restaurant that she owned here in Hollywood. And my dad needed one for a musician, so that's how they met and became friends. And she was a regular at the Fez. She taught a lot of dancers that ended up dancing there. And when she left Hollywood and went to San Francisco to open the Baghdad Cafe, which, by the way, she did because she met this drummer, Yusuf Kyumjin, at the Fez. And from meeting him at the Fez, they decided to go to San Francisco and start the Baghdad. Of course, I'm paraphrasing a little bit. I'm putting a lot of history into like a little bit of time. So when she went to San Francisco and started her club there, she would often come down to L.A. and borrow dancers from the Fez and take them up to perform at the Baghdad in San Francisco, and they would kind of go back and forth. So there was a lot of exchange between the two places. So that was the very early days. I'm talking about late 50s and 60s. Then when you go into the 70s, dancers like Fatim, I believe, and I don't remember off the top of my head now if Angelica actually performed at the Fez or if she's from the next generation. Another dancer whose name just slipped my mind. Oh, Anahid. And Anahid reminds me of another amazing person who danced at the Fez regularly, who was Diane Weber. Mm. Do you know who Diane Weber is?
I think so, yes.
Okay. And many, many more, you know. I'm giving you the real, like, main people, main dancers, but there were lots of other really incredible dancers that performed there.
And so, you know, for this first generation of dancers, do we really know how they got started, given that there weren't really belly dance classes at every dance studio at this point?
Yes, and that's the really interesting thing. They became dancers out of a necessity. You know, there were none, and people wanted dancers, and now all of a sudden there's this nightclub that is providing an environment where they needed dancers. And so a lot of them would just learn by watching. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, they would go from club to club and watch each other. There were really no teachers, and a lot of the dancers were sort of, they shied away from actually teaching. So, you know, it was difficult. And then you had my father, who I think this is one of the really amazing things about him, was that he could really see the potential in people. You know, and he knew that, you know, you're not going to become an amazing dancer from learning to dance in a studio. You're going to become an amazing dancer from performing and from experiencing the music and having those opportunities to perform. So he would often have, you know, he'd bring in these new girls who were just learning and give them a chance to cut their teeth and really learn to become excellent dancers. For example, Sahra. I mean, I don't know if you're out there listening, Sahra. She might get mad at me for telling this story, but I doubt it. You know, when Sahra started dancing, she was not the dancer that we know today. And, you know, my dad, or she jokingly says that, you know, my dad was going to fire her if she didn't go take dance classes from Fairuz Aram, because she needed to get that grounding and, you know, learn the real earthiness, which is something that Fairuz was really great at. So he gave her a chance, and I remember I was 9 or 10 years old when she started dancing there, and my dad would look at her and say, look at the expression in her face. She doesn't really know what she's doing yet, but she's going to. You know, and he gave her the opportunity to perform 3 nights a week, several times a night. And because of that, she became the dancer that we know and love today. So I think that's something that we unfortunately are really lacking in our art form today, and that is the ability to develop as an artist.
I was very lucky to have a situation like that. I mean, I did have classes, and I got my teacher's
right.
But when I was getting my start, we had more than one venue and a couple of hofflas with live music.
Yes.
Regularly, and we all had this ability to get out there and try it. And you know, I think I very much agree. Sometimes you learn more just by doing it.
Absolutely.
Than you do on stage. So, which is
Absolutely.
Not to say that preparation isn't important. You know, everybody keep going to class.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's not to say that technique wasn't important. I mean, they did the best they could with what they had in those days. And, you know, there was a lot of, it was the 60s, so there was a lot more freedom of expression then. You know what I mean? And then I think the great thing for a lot of those dancers is they were also dancing for Arabic people. And so they were learning to become dancers that were culturally acceptable because they were dancing for people of the culture. So I think that helped to shape them a lot as well.
Absolutely. I think that's actually one of the biggest differences I'm seeing, you know, in the dance community, even since I've been aware of what's going on in the dance community, is
mm-hmm.
that, you know, we're moving away from being vetted by the cultural audiences that we've traditionally been vetted by, and now we're being vetted more and more by other dancers. And that shifts our priorities.
Yes, it really does.
Anyway, that was a little bit of a tangent, so I'm sorry about that.
It's okay. You caught me because I was just thinking, do I want to go off on that tangent? Because I could say a lot about that, but I'll let
you
guide.
If you want, you can, but I'll leave that up to you.
I'm just going to say this. I think that if you've only ever had a chance to perform to recorded music for 3 minutes in a showcase for other dancers, then, you know, you're missing out on a whole lot. And we live in a world today where we have everything at our fingertips. You know, if you live in a place and you're listening to this that you don't have an Arabic community nearby you where you could go to a church festival or a wedding or a nightclub or a restaurant and actually experience the culture for yourself, you have the internet, you have YouTube, you have Skype, you have, you know, all of these things available to you. So look for an opportunity to dance to live music, to improvise, and to be among the people of the culture in any way that you can, because that's really what's going to make you a good belly dancer, in my opinion.
Absolutely. And anytime you find anybody who can hook you up with those things, make very good friends with them and be grateful.
Exactly. Exactly. It's sad, I think. You know, there was a time, you know, right now I'm focusing on the documentary, so I'm not doing as much promoting as I have in the past. But I was putting on a regular, you know, monthly showcase at an Arabic nightclub nearby, and I was paying a band so that we could all dance to live music and have that experience. And when dancers would call me to sign up, they'd say, can I dance to my CD on the break? And I'd say, but I'm putting this on so you have an opportunity to learn to dance to live music. Oh, but I don't know how to dance to live music. And it just, like, would break my heart. And I'm going, the only way you're going to learn is by doing it. But anyway, back to the topic we were talking about.
All right. So we're coming back into this idea of, you know, the dancers and how they got started.
Yeah.
You know, but a follow-up question to that is, you know, how did the shows that they were doing then compare to what we get now?
Oh, you're going to die when I tell you this.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know that, at least at the Fez, their shows were 45 minutes long, at least.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is the biggest difference than what we get today. And that's because, you know, you'd start off with an opening song and come out with... I think we consider this an abcam style, which is to come out wrapped up in a veil playing finger cymbals, you know, and then unwrap the veil and dance with the veil. Well, that style started at the Fez, according to Aisha Ali and Antoinette and other dancers that were there. That style started there. So, you know, you'd come out, you'd dance with your veil and play your finger cymbals, and then they would go into maybe a slower taksim song. Then each instrument, which could be five or six instruments, would go into their taksim, each one of, you know, having a solo. And then drum solos weren't really big in those days. Drum solos didn't really start happening until later on. And drum solos are a result of belly dance shows. Drum solos don't just happen naturally in Arabic music, for the most part. So, you know, there'd maybe be a little drum section, and then maybe, you know, they also did floor work in those days a lot, so they'd do a little floor work, then they'd do, like, a closing number, and that would be 45 minutes. Oh, my gosh, I just remembered another dancer I neglected to mention, Helena Vlahos. Helena Vlahos, who is Greek, but is an amazing Arabic-style belly dancer. She's famous for rolling the seven quarters on her stomach.
Mm-hmm.
And she is still teaching today and is an amazing performer and teacher. So if you're ever in the Los Angeles area or... you see her in your town teaching a workshop, go take a class from her.
I took a class with her at the Las Vegas Belly Dance Intensive last year.
Oh.
And it was wonderful.
Isn't she wonderful?
I fully second that recommendation.
And she's so great to talk to. I could listen to her talk all night. She has this beautiful Greek accent. And, you know, a lot of these dancers are still part of the dance community and doing things. You know, Aisha is still teaching and is, you know, still researching. She just recently put out a new DVD documentary called Wedding in Luxor. Zanuba, the dancer I mentioned, who's Armenian-Egyptian, that danced at the opening night on the Fez, she's like 84 years old. And she lives in the Seattle area. Amazing lady. Fairuz Aram lives also in the Seattle area and is coming back to the dance world as well. You know, we're just very lucky to have these ladies and the amazing stories they have, the amazing things they've done for our dance form. And we wouldn't really be where we are today if it wasn't for
mm-hmm. I love all this talk about lineage, because I think that, you know, again, when we talk about regional styles, in a lot of cases, it's not so much, you know, well, what city are you from, but who is your teacher and who is her teacher?
Yes.
That affects some of these big stylistic things. So I'm really glad that you're getting into some of that information here.
You know, I do want to say one thing about that. There's so much information that I've gathered from this process. And there's no way I can fit it all into a documentary. Because I probably have 50 or 60 hours of footage, just raw footage. But what my intention is, because I started this process of the Fez documentary as a dance history documentary. You know, I'm a dancer, so I approached it from what is our lineage? Why did this start and how did it develop? So what I plan to do is, once the documentary is finished, do a rough edit of each one of the interviews of these dancers and musicians and make them available through the Fez website. And for a few dollar digital download, those of you dancers who are out there that really want to study and know more about our dance history, you can hear the whole interview of Fairuz. You can hear the whole interview of Aisha and all these other dancers and musicians that were a part of it. So I'm an educator at heart, and it's really important to me to make the information available to the people who want to access it.
I think that would be wonderful, and I would definitely pay for that, so I'm sure other people will too. So hopefully we can support the project that way as well.
Thank you. I would hope so.
Excellent. Now, if you look just a little bit outside of L.A., you know, you talked about that there was some kind of exchange of dancers between L.A. and San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Did that happen with any other areas as well?
That's a good question. I know that at different points in time, and this is really just off the top of my head, so forgive me if I'm not completely accurate, but my own experience. I know that in the 80s, for example, there was a really popular nightclub in Mexico City. I want to say called Adonis. But they would bring dancers from Los Angeles to perform there. And I know Sahara was one of those dancers that got to perform there. And probably San Diego as well, although now San Diego has a big Arabic community and a lot of dancers living down there. But I would imagine, I'm just guessing, that probably San Diego brought dancers from L.A. as well. And then I know that there are communities of Middle Eastern people in the Las Vegas area that, before there was a community there, brought dancers to Vegas, Phoenix, and I want to say other places in the Southwest, like Texas. And I think that's pretty much what I can tell you about from my own experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, this has been super interesting. Is there anything that I didn't ask you about that you want to talk about?
Well, I think we covered a lot of it. I'd like to tell you that if you are going to be in the Los Angeles area, June 6th and 7th for a Cairo Shimmy Quake, I am going to be there, and I'm going to be vending T-shirts, and you can pre-order the DVD of the documentary. Also, this is important to know, one of the very first albums, and I'm talking about a record album, for those of you who are not familiar with a record, go to Google and Google record album. In the early 1970s, one of the very first records of a belly dance routine was recorded live at the Fez, and that album is called Live at the Fez. And until now, it's still only on record form. So as part of this project, I'm also having that cleaned up and transferred to a digital format and also CD. So that music will be available, and it's really great, great, great old school belly dance stuff. So we're also going to do a sneak peek of about 15-20 minute section of the documentary. It's free to the public. It'll be on Sunday evening at the end of the festival. So if you're there, you can just come on down and watch part of the documentary. I'll also have actual fezes, the hats you wear, the little red hat with the black tassel, direct from Egypt, so they are authentic. You can get your fez, and I'll also be in Austin, Texas with Bahia the weekend of July 11th and 12th, and we're going to be showing the documentary there. I'm going to be teaching a fez routine and also teaching Khaliji, which is another dance form that I love. So there's lots of great stuff coming up, and I'm really hoping to be able to take this documentary around the country, share it with people, and just make part of our really rich dance history available to all those that are interested.
Excellent.
Sorry for the shameless plug. I just realized I sound like a commercial right there.
You know, that was on my list of questions to ask you.
Mm-hmm.
You just knew I was going there, that's all.
Yes.
Now, about the documentary, is that ready to pre-order now?
No. Not yet.
So is there a way that people can get on some kind of notification list, or should they check back at a particular place?
What I would do is check back on the website, thefezdoc.com, in the beginning of June, and we will have a sign up there where you could pre-order the documentary. And we're hoping that the documentary will be ready to ship out in, you know, beginning to middle of July. So we're almost there. It's a never-ending process. Every time I think I'm almost done, there's always a little bit more to do. But we're close. We're very close. So.
Excellent. And if people wanted to do something like arrange a screening for their dance community, is that something they could discuss with you?
Oh, absolutely. I would be more than happy to go to your town and screen the documentary. We could do a Q&A. We could, you know, I'm open to ideas. So please feel free to contact me. You can contact me through the Fez website, again, www.thefezdoc.com, or you can find me on Facebook at the Fez Documentary or at my own Facebook page, which is Roxanne with two X's and two N's, Shelaby, spelled the Arabic way, Shelaby.
Excellent. And if, you know, if our listeners take one thing away from this call, what would you want that to be?
That our dance form is a sacred thing. It is a dance that comes out of a culture, and it's shaped by the culture, and it also shapes the culture. So, you know, do fusion. You know, take the dance in new and exciting ways, but know the foundation, know the culture, know the traditional, authentic belly dancing, and then take it where you want it to go. But know your roots.
That's so important. All right, so why don't we go ahead and open this up for questions and answers. So if there are folks who are listening to the webcast, you can type in a question by clicking on the little speech bubble on the right-hand side of your screen, and you can type in your question there. Or if you're on the phone or Skype, you can unmute yourself by pressing **. So that's ** on your phone or *** on the Skype keypad. And once you unmute yourself, just say hello and where you're from so we know where you are. We can take questions, or if you want to share a tidbit that you think is related, we'd love to hear that, or even
Please.
Your favorite thing that you learned. We don't have any takers yet, but somebody has
Uh-oh.
To be the first one, so if you volunteer, I would love to hear it. Sometimes when we have a really good call, we get no questions because we covered everything, and sometimes when we have a really good call, we get a million questions.
Well, hopefully somebody's going to say something, otherwise I'm going to have to start singing, and nobody wants that.
My threat is I'm going to start talking about my cats.
Yes. Oh, I got some good cat stories, too.
All right, I think we have a caller unmuted. Hi there.
Am I unmuted?
Yes, you are.
Okay. I'm Kava. Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you. That was fascinating. And
oh,
I was just wondering why some of the dancers shied away from teaching.
Well, that's a really great question. One of the dancers, Feyruz, she said that when, you know, she first was asked to start teaching, she was afraid that teaching and having to really analyze what she was doing was going to make her lose the magic, you know? Because, again, these were dancers who started, you know, their only experience with dancing was improvising. It was all in the moment. It was all to live music. And the idea of crystallizing it into an idea to share with someone else was scary. However, all of them have said that teaching became one of the most important aspects of their dance careers to them. So although they were scared a little bit at first, it wasn't something that prohibited them from teaching.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for such a great question.
That was a good question. Do you have any more?
Not at the moment. I just want to go to L.A. immediately.
Come down anytime.
Thanks.
You know, one of the things I love to do when people come to town or, you know, dancers come in is I take them on a little cultural tour of Los Angeles or the Los Angeles area, and we go to the nightclubs. And I'm working on a cultural immersion program, which if you know Sahra and she does her journey through Egypt where she takes people to Egypt, you know, my thing is that, you know, we have a whole rich dance culture here in the Southern California area that you can experience. So my intention is to take dancers on field trips to places like cultural events and festivals and nightclubs and so forth, and also have lectures and have discussions where we, you know, go a little bit deeper into the culture and so forth. So I'm working on that. It's still not a fully cooked idea yet, but it's coming soon.
I think that's a wonderful idea. I was really lucky to have a mentor. She wasn't my teacher, but she was, you know, a much more experienced dancer. And she did some of that with me. And, you know, she took me to the TV repair shop that was Half Music Store, which is the best place to buy CDs in Boston.
Right, right.
And all these little connections, and, you know, even, you know, the Lebanese bakery.
Yes, you took the words out of my mouth. I was about to say, you have to have fresh pita bread sometime in your life.
Absolutely. So I really hope you do that, because that, even the little taste of that I've had was really helpful for me. So that would be awesome.
Yes. And who was your dance mentor?
Her name is Amina Dalal.
Oh, okay. That name sounds familiar
to me. Actually, a lot
of
people might know the store I'm talking about. It's Acme TV. They used to have a mail order catalog.
That's hilarious.
Excellent. All right. So are there any more questions we can take, folks? Again, you can press ** on your phone or Skype keypad, or if you're on the webcast, you can type in your question.
Excuse me. Sorry.
Looks like we've got a caller from area code 661.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes. Hello.
Oh, hi. Sorry. It's Candace Cold-Eland.
How are you? Thanks for calling in.
Sure. I was just wondering, the beginning of the conversation, I was wondering how the DVD or the documentary will be available, because if it's available in download formats or anything, or by DVD to purchase, because usually I struggle to get things to New Zealand from the US, so I was just wondering what different formats you're going to have it available in.
Yes, we are going to have a DVD format for those people who are interested in that, and it will also be available on digital download. So thank you for asking that question, because that's, as well as the music. The music for Live from the Fez will be in CD and digital download format.
Oh, that's excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and love your beautiful New Zealand accent. Thank you for calling.
Thanks.
Thanks, Candice. It's good to hear your voice.
Happy to hear you too, New
Year. Excellent. Is there anything else you'd like to ask while we've got you unmuted?
No, it was a really interesting talk, so thanks for sharing all the information about it.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Well,
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Okay. So I'm going to put Candice back on mute. And if there's anything else that anybody would like to ask or to say, we'd love to hear it. Again, that's ** on your phone or Skype keypad. Well, I think we are going to call it a night then. Thank you so much, Roxanne.
It's been my pleasure. And again, if anybody out there thinks of questions or anything they'd like to add or talk to me about, you're please welcome to contact me. And I love to continue to talk about this subject. So thank you again, Nadira. This has been really a wonderful experience, and I can't thank you enough for your support.
My pleasure. And thank you, everybody, for coming. This is the end of the call, but as Roxanne mentioned, that doesn't mean that the conversation has to end.
Mm-hmm,
so you can contact
mm-hmm.
Roxanne directly if you'd like. We also have a private Facebook group for Clubhouse members.
Right.
But there is an approval delay, so I'll be sending out an email which will have an invitation link. But after you request to join the group, then you have to wait a couple hours or a day for me to approve you, just to make sure that we don't get any crazies in there.
Yes, good idea.
Yeah, I just make sure that everybody looks like a dancer.
Right.
It's not a super exclusive thing, but, you know, we like to keep it mostly dancers.
Yeah,
I agree. We'll also include a link to the call recording, so if you want to go back and listen again or pick up a section that you might have missed, you can do that. And I'll also have a link to the Fez documentary site, so you can click directly through. And I'm also going to include a survey. I run the Clubhouse, but it's really for all of you. So if there are any topics you'd like to hear, any speakers that you'd like me to invite, or any ways that I can improve this, I'd love to hear it. And our next call has not been scheduled yet. It's coming up in June, and our topic is going to be contracts for dancers. So keep an eye on your inbox for the schedule. And the very last thing that I'd like to say is that this is the coming-in kind of Clubhouse, not the no-boys-allowed kind. So if you know somebody who would enjoy these calls, you can invite them to join us at bellydancegeek.com/clubhouse. And until next time, happy dancing. Good night, everybody.
Thanks for listening. For more geektacular resources, check out bellydancegeek.com.